Today is Friday. It's June 13th, 2025, and this is part 6 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Don Christensen. Don spells his last name C-H-R-I-S-T-E-N-S-E-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Don. How are you today?
I'm fine, sir.
Great. Don, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, indeed.
Thank you very much. Don, you wrapped up part 5 with some amazing recountings of surveys that you had done in from 1985 to 1995 at Petrified Forest National Park. And you and I had talked about other things you were doing in that same time period. And you were also doing surveys on the Mojave Desert. Can you talk to that?
That's really difficult to describe, and I did work in the Mojave for a long decades actually.
Okay.
And eventually I recorded 294 rock art sites in the Mojave over about three decades.
Wow.
And then I even did a project in Joshua Tree National Park and recorded another 101 sites there.
Oh my gosh. When did you work in Joshua?
About that same period of time.
Okay. Was Kurt Sauer the superintendent then?
Who now?
A gentleman named Kurt Sauer.
I don't remember that.
Okay.
I rarely got into the administration office. I stayed clear of that place.
Okay.
That's all just petty politics.
Yeah. Who was your park liaison there? Do you remember?
I do not remember. It was a gal. And she actually lived in Joshua Tree.
Okay.
And we did meet at her house one time, and I cannot remember her name. She was a nice lady.
Okay.
Anyway, so yeah, the Mojave was an ongoing project that I did frequently. I met Jerry Dickey there in the Mojave, and we had been recruited by a gal whose name I can't even recall, which is just as well. She was a dingbat. And she tried to get a bunch of people together to record rock art in the Mojave. And so she contacted some people she knew that had an interest in her, that she had run into here and there and everywhere heard from. And we all met out in one location, which had a lot of rock art. And it became apparent within about 15 minutes that these people had no idea what they were doing.
Mm.
They didn't know how to do rock art. They brought out an aiming circle doing mapping and stuff, and nobody knew how to use it. And I did, and I kept my mouth shut because I didn't want to get stuck with that job. That's boring. And at lunchtime, there was another guy out there that was sitting around looking perplexed at me, and that was Jerry Dickey. So we got to talking. And by the end of the day, I said, Jerry, what do you think of this project this gal is doing? God, I almost had her name there for a minute. Well, it's best we forget her name. Anyway, I said, this is going nowhere. I'm not coming back to this place. And Jerry said, no, I'm not either. I said, you know what? I know where there's a lot of sites. Maybe you do too. He said, not too many. I said, well, hey, we ought to get together and we'll come out and check these sites out. So we did. And that was the beginning of my association with Jerry Dickey, which continues down to the present day, although I don't see Jerry too often anymore.
And when was that? Do you remember?
Don.
80s, 90s?
In 90s.
Okay.
And no, 80s. It'd be in the 80s.
Okay.
It'd be in the 80s. Yeah. Anyway, so we did a long series of recordings in various parts of the park or of the Mojave Desert.
Okay. So hang on for a second. I want to open this up a little bit. When you know, I think of what you have recounted about Petrified, when I think of the Mojave, then that's Bureau of Land Management land. Was there an agency person that you worked with, or would you just do these ARC site surveys and then send them off to the agency?
Because I was submitting site reports to the agency.
Okay.
To the BLM.
All right.
So we worked with the BLM out of Barstow occasionally. Most of it was out of Beautiful Needles.
Okay.
And I got to know the guy. I got to know the guy in Needles pretty well because Needles is a horrible outpost.
Oh my gosh! Who was the? Do you remember that guy's name?
God, I'll eventually find it and get it to you because
yeah.
I do remember him.
Because I'd like to ask you about him, and you know, it, as you say, it's a terrible outpost. And so, what was that guy like?
Yeah, and he had a wife, and he had a kid, and. That was not a place you wanted to send your kid to school and raise your family.
Mm.
So he transferred out of there as soon as he could.
Wow.
We did work for a guy named John Rose, R-O-S-E. And John was a PhD who did his dissertation, believe it or not, on Mayan lithics.
Oh, wow.
Mayan, M-A-Y-A. God almighty. Poor. And here he is. He's stuck in Needles. And,
wow.
And he eventually got out and went on to bigger and better things. In fact, I think he moved to Idaho. But anyway, so we had contact with those guys, but that was a tough deal for
those. What do you remember about
people.
John?
I'm sorry, what now?
What do you remember about John Rose?
Very nice guy, very knowledgeable, and he didn't talk much about the Mayans.
Okay.
You know, those poor guys, when you're an agency archaeologist, it's hard to escape from the politics of the organization.
Yep.
And that frustrated the bejeebers out of him.
Because
there are always people that were sitting in an office in Barstow or somewhere.
Right.
And telling you what to do, and it was nonsensical.
Hmm. Huh. That's tough.
Anyway.
Okay. All right. So these were the people you were reporting to. And then,
right.
And then you knew of some sites, and Jerry knew of some sites.
I knew of a lot of sites. I'd been kicking around the Mojave for a long time.
Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, yeah. I started out academically as a geology major.
Okay.
And then when I was in junior college, I had to take a chemistry class, and the chemistry professor was a woman who was on a crusade to prove that men were stupid.
Okay.
And she passed 17 people out of 100 and some in chemistry 1A. And when I went to sign up for chemistry 1B, she says, "Christensen, you were the last C I gave. You couldn't transfer anything lower than a C."
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "You were the last C I gave." And she says, "You won't survive chemistry 1B." And I believed her.
Wow.
So that's when I moved to the social sciences.
Okay.
By the way, at the end of the year, they fired her.
Well, you,
but it was too late for me.
Yeah, you mentioned that last time, but I'm thinking about the Mojave, and how was it that you got out and started exploring the Mojave?
Because I was interested in geology, and my dad was kind of interested in being he was kind of a rock hound.
Okay.
And he eventually had in the garage a small... grinding wheel and a polishing wheel, and he actually, you know, cut and polished some rocks.
Did he have a tumbler?
You know, yeah, no, we did. We did do tumbling later.
Okay.
Later.
Okay.
Anyway,
but
so
he was
got
polishing and cutting. Okay, very good.
Oh. Yeah, he liked that.
Okay.
And it was something very different. The guy was an electrician, for God's sake, and it was something different for him to do, and he liked that.
Yeah.
So we would go out and rock hound.
Okay.
And, of course, the Mojave has got all kinds of cryptocrystallines out there, so there's lots of stuff to find.
Okay.
So we made frequent trips as a family, well, my dad and I, to the Mojave. My mom wasn't much on digging around in the dirt.
Okay.
So
this would be during
the
winter when it was nice out there?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Wintertime, it's not bad. In fact, it can snow and it gets cold and it goes into the 20s. And
okay.
It's a cold desert.
All right.
Anyway, so I had background. And so Jerry and I started recording sites and submitting them to Needles, mainly to the archaeologists in Needles. And that was a continually changing cast of who was on duty in Needles, because those guys, as soon as they could, got the hell out of Needles.
Okay.
And
okay.
I couldn't blame them.
All right.
It was okay to stop and buy gas in Needles, but there's hardly any other reason to be in that town.
Okay.
Well, in fact, gas is ridiculously expensive. So there is a bridge in Needles that takes you over to the Arizona side.
Right.
So we would drive across the bridge into Arizona, and we could buy gas for about a dollar and a half more cheaper than we could in Needles.
Right, right. And there's what? If you keep going east on the highway, after a few miles, you come to a big truck stop.
Yeah, several. Yes, there is.
Yeah,
because
okay.
there's a place where you can turn south and go down to Lake Havasu
right.
City and all that stuff.
That's right, at that junction, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so that's pretty good. You drive out there and then go fuel up before going home, which makes a lot of sense. What do you remember about Jerry when you guys first met?
He was really interested in rock art. In fact, he and I had both, unknown to each other, had attended our first American Rock Art Research Association meeting that was held in Santa Barbara. And I had gone and he had gone, and we didn't know it. And because, it, you know, there was maybe 100 people there. And so it was easy to just get lost in the crowd.
Okay.
And that was my first meeting with those folks. And that's where I met Frank and AJ Bach. And they would show up in Petrified Forest, and then I would do recording for them in southern Utah.
Got it.
So I had a long association with the Bachs.
Got it.
And AJ and I hit it right off because we were both, lapsed Mormons.
Okay.
Who had figured out that was a bunch of baloney and moved on to other things. But we both came from that background. And we both came from pioneers. I mean, you know, folks that had been in Utah for a long time.
Okay.
Mine came into Utah in the 1850s.
Okay.
So, and AJ was about as, her ancestry was about as old as that, too.
Okay.
So anyway, we had empathy for each other.
Okay.
Anyway, getting back to the Mojave. So I did small sites here and there, and then occasionally I would get nailed to a big site. My most memorable screw up. John Rose took me out and she was showing me some sites along the Arizona side of the Colorado River.
Okay.
And so we stopped and looked at one site and I go, wow, that's neat. And then we stopped and looked at another and I, well, that's an interesting site. And he says, well, and then we stopped and looked at a third one. He says, well, are there any of these sites you can do? I said, well, those are manageable. What I did not realize, and John did not either, those three sites were all connected together.
Oh, wow. How did you figure that out, that they were connected?
When I started mapping.
Okay.
I had to do a map, and, you know, obviously you always do a map on an arc site.
Yeah.
And as I expanded my map, I go, Christ, this loci is connected to the next one.
So,
and the next one, and the next one. And I think I wound up with damn near 1,000 elements, 1,000 panels. And it took me years. I was I was out there for a long time.
Wow.
But one year it was well worth it because we had a super bloom because we'd had a lot of winter rain, which was unusual. And we had a proliferation of California poppies.
Oh, my gosh.
And the whole valley was just loaded with poppies.
Wow.
It was eye-popping.
Wow.
It was just amazing. So that was well worth it, I guess. Anyway,
so let me make sure I understand this. He would have driven along some dirt road, I suppose, and he'd have stopped and walked over to a boulder and said, okay, well, there's a site here. You guys, you'd looked at it. Okay, fine. Get back in your truck. Drive another half a mile or quarter mile. And then he'd say, that's another
half mile or a mile.
And so when you actually surveyed it, you went from boulder to boulder to boulder to boulder to the next site?
Yes.
Oh my gosh!
There might be 100, 200 meters between the okay. low size.
Wow!
But it was close enough that you know it was within sight. So you just kind of like, okay, we'll just make this a different locus.
Loci. Wow! Yeah.
I think I wound up with maybe 6 or 8 loci on that site.
Okay. All right. And then I'm assuming that this was in sight of the Colorado River.
No, it wasn't. There was there's a range of mountains that separates that valley from the valley that all these sites were in. It was called the Hualapai Valley.
Okay.
And there's a small range of mountains that blocks off your view from the river.
Okay. Wow. So this is not, because I'm thinking, you know, you have food, shelter, clothing, you got all that stuff down by the river. So if you got some rocks near the river, you can do art, you can do, you know, ceremonial or whatever, sort of glyphs there. But, well, this is further away. And this is that's amazing. That's a powerful place there to have.
You know, it's interesting. I got sidetracked now and then. There are trails, and you can still see the prehistoric trails in the Mojave because it's so arid.
Mm-hmm.
And when people start tromping over the landscape for a while, they leave their tracks.
Yeah.
So I got onto the kick of hiking trails.
Okay.
And I would find petroglyphs on them. I would find ceramic scatters, cairns. I found cairns. And sometimes those cairns were gigantic. I found one. I recorded one cairn that was 10 by 15 meters.
Whoa!
And it was probably 2 feet tall.
Wow!
And it was like everybody that walked by that cairn threw another rock on the pile.
Yeah, it was like what you
had
to do.
And the interesting thing is, after a while, that thing got bigger and bigger and bigger. People started picking up pieces of caliche. Because they'll form into blobs,
yeah.
And they throw the caliche on it. So there was kind of like a white cap on it from the caliche boulders that people threw on it. It was really interesting. And I like trails. Trails are neat because you just don't know where they're going to go and what you're going to find along them.
Yeah.
And later on, I wrote a paper on cairns because there's a couple of sites in the Mojave where there are, God, how many? almost 100 cairns, just little piles of pebbles in mounds stuck here, there, and everywhere. And within proximity, you might have a 100 by 50 meter area, and you got like 100 cairns in it.
Wow. What do you think's going on there?
I have no idea. Those all used to befuddle me. That's why I got attracted to them.
Huh.
It's another question you can't answer, so therefore you're going to spend time on it.
This reminds me of the Hopi Salt Trail, which connects the rim down to the Little Colorado River. And
I got to know a guy named Eckhart Malotke.
Yes.
You ever run into him?
No, I've heard of him. I have never met him.
He is of German-American extraction. And he got so infatuated with the Hopi that he actually learned the language.
Okay.
And he may be the only European who can speak Hopi.
Wow.
And he's published extensively on it.
Okay.
And he's a dingbat. I mean, it's a little bit of Malotke goes a long ways.
Okay.
And he came out and even helped us on surveys a couple of times in the Petrified Forest.
Okay.
And I will never forget, he decided that he was going to show me how a split twig figurine is made.
Okay.
Because those show up in some of the caves in the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
And so he said, yeah, let me show you how to make a split twig figurine. So he borrowed my pocket knife. Ooh. And I said, be careful, it's really sharp.
Oh, no.
And by God, he cut his finger. And he bled like a pig, and I finally got the bleeding stop, and he actually went into shock.
Oh my gosh.
Over a cut finger. And I was just, I can't believe this, because I cut my finger all the time, you know. It's just a normal thing you do when you're messing around.
Have a knife. Really sharp knife, exactly. You get cut.
Yeah, Eckhart was a special guy. He was a little different.
Well, I digress, because on that route, at the top of the Red Wall, there is a meter and a half high by meter and a half wide cairn there. And it's not with big chunky rocks. It's with fist-sized, small-sized rocks. On the way, of course, you know, that's an important place for the Hopi. On their way there. So, okay.
You could probably define that as a shrine.
Okay.
Because they make rock piles sometimes become shrines for them.
Huh. Okay.
And they will deposit sherds.
Okay.
One of the favorite things they'll drop on some of those shrines are Jeddito yellow wear. That very distinctive Hopi wear, the yellow wear stuff. That's almost historic. It comes really late in time, Tara.
This was right where there's a drop down through the red wall. So it's like, okay, go here.
You're at the top of the red wall.
Top of the red wall. And it just marked, you know, it was like, you got there, you get the cairn, and then right there is a way down. So it's kind of, anyway, that was, you know, one of few, if I think about this, but you've seen like 100 of them in one small area. That's fascinating.
Right.
Never think about that.
So you were actually on the Esplanade, which I'm going to get to here eventually.
Yeah.
Because that's very significant.
Okay. So we're talking about the Mojave, and we're talking about the sites.
Let's go back to
finding
the Mojave, and I'll do what I can with that. The Mojave is hard to describe because it's all these little dinky mountain ranges, not very tall, scattered all over the place with big long playas in between. And even some of the playas have, some of the valleys have playas or dry lakes at the bottom.
Right.
Which will occasionally get water in them if it rains enough. And I worked on a ton of sites. 294 sites. I look back at that and I'm going, that was nuts. And then the Joshua Tree National Park starts right on into it. So you just blend right in. You don't even know there's a distinction. It's just an administrative distinction.
Okay. Okay.
And most of the vegetation is creosote, pretty exciting stuff, burrow weed. But the ranges will have pinyon and juniper in them.
Okay.
And then some of the valleys actually have Joshua trees.
Okay.
And sometimes it's extensive.
Hmm. All right.
The unfortunate thing was that one year we had a lot of winter rain, and in the spring we had a lot of cheatgrass.
Oh, no.
And then it dried out, and then when the monsoon came through, we get a little monsoon in the desert occasionally, not much, but enough that you get lightning strikes.
Yep.
And it set the cheatgrass on fire. And it burnt the bejeebers out of 1,000 acres plus.
Oh, my gosh. Of the Joshua.
In fact, the classic story was, as firefighters from the Bureau of Land Management and from, God, maybe the Park Service, were standing on a road that runs east-west across the Mojave, debating who would cover the next area. And while they're talking, the fire jumps the road and takes off into, to another mountain range and burned another, 500,000 acres or something ridiculous. It was just, everybody was just really upset about that. And they were embarrassed too. They should have been the jerks.
I'm sure.
Anyway.
Gosh.
So, the predominant rock art in the Mojave is what we call Western Archaic, which is predominantly non-representational. People want to call it abstract, but and it is abstract to a degree, but it's not figurative. Although there is figurative rock out there, but over and over and over again, when you look at the final summation, not representational stuff, zoomorphs and anthropomorphs and that kind of stuff was 5% or less.
Wow. Wow.
So there is a little bit of things. It's usually bighorn sheep.
Which is so different from the Esplanade style out in the Grand Canyon.
Oh, God, yeah. Huh. Yeah, in fact, that was what was nice about working at Petrified Forest is you actually had rock art that showed figures.
Uh-huh, okay.
because I was used to stuff that, you know, it's all, you know, non-representational stuff,
right.
Squiggly lines and circles and lines and squares and all kinds of goofy stuff. So anyway, we worked on that for a number of years, published a couple of articles on it. And that was kind of the thing I kind of specialized in for a long time.
Okay.
Go ahead.
You and Jerry would go on out there a couple times a year, maybe?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Probably I would go out more often than Jerry. Jerry had family obligations.
Okay.
So
you would go out there five or ten?
I don't know. This isn't appropriate, but just for your background, Jerry and his wife did not have children of their own.
Mm-hmm.
Because his wife, my God, within the first year of their marriage, had cancer of the ovaries and had to have that all removed and taken care of. And she survived it, bless her heart. Mm-hmm. And she's still alive.
Yeah.
But anyway, they adopted. And they adopted a daughter and a son. And their son is a nice kid, a good kid, but he's not the sharpest tool in the shed.
Okay.
And so he required a little extra attention. And his daughter was brilliant and a proverbial liar. She knew exactly what to tell adults and to try and wiggle her way into doing as least amount of stuff as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So his kids took a lot of time, and mine fortunately did not. Now my kids were pretty squared away in that respect. I think I just got lucky. That's all, and they're still good kids.
Well, it might be a credit to your wife.
I would give about 90% of the credit to her. Yes.
Okay. Thinking about
that,
these
but
things.
She's not around to hear that anymore. But
right,
yeah, I would.
Right.
Anyway.
All right, so you were spending more
so
time
there is,
out there.
There is some rock art in the Mojave that you could identify as Patayan, P-A-T-A-Y-A-N. And that's a group that you find in western Arizona.
Okay.
And it spills over across the river into eastern California a little bit. So we had some Patayan sites in the eastern Mojave.
Okay.
Archaeologists in California don't like the word Patayan because I don't know why they don't, but that's a good term to describe who those folks were, because ethnically they are different. They're different folks.
What did they use instead of Patayan?
They just call them Southern Paiute.
Okay.
They just want to make everybody in the desert Southern Paiute.
Oh, wow.
And that's not correct.
Okay.
There are Southern Paiute out there, obviously, but
right,
you know.
Huh.
And one of the things that confuses, I think, the California situation is there is no reservations out there to speak of.
Right.
Along the periphery of the Colorado River, there is the Chemehuevi.
Right.
And I actually recorded a site one time because the Chemehuevi asked me to.
Oh, cool.
And I was kind of surprised. And then there is the Mojave.
Right.
And I eventually became, I think, pretty good friends with a Mojave elder. He was great. He really was.
Cool.
But my working with Native Americans is that I never ask them any questions.
Hmm. Okay.
I know that's hard for a white man to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because you always want to know why.
Hmm.
But if they wanted to tell me things, I would just wait until they would tell me. And Felden Bricker was the Mojave I worked with.
What was
Felden?
How do you spell his name?
Felden, F-E-L-D-O-N.
Okay.
Bricker, B-R-I-C-K-E-R.
Sorry, and then you were just talking about what you remembered about him.
Yeah, Felden was a good guy. But he used to play with my mind a little bit. I'd take him out to show him sites that he hadn't seen before. And sometimes he'd leave offerings there, or a pinch of tobacco or something like that. And he used to say, "Did you see that?" I go, "What?" He says, "Oh, never mind." And he used to pretend, I think he was pretending, that he saw things that I didn't see. And I think it was just a goof with me a little bit. Uh-huh. And I didn't take it personal.
Yeah.
I started hosting in the Mojave something called the Mojave Rock Art Research Project. And I invited, because Jerry and I got to talking one time. We got snowed out of the Mojave. So it's snowing and we can't do anything. So we're in the car and we're driving home. And I go, you know, Jerry, there's got to be other people doing research in the Mojave besides you and I.
Hmm.
And he said, yeah. I said, we ought to have a conference where we get people we think are doing research in the Mojave and get together and sit down and talk about it.
Oh, cool.
And maybe get people to give a short presentation on what they're doing and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
That wound up becoming the Mojave Rock Art Research Program. And we ran it annually. God, for how many years? I'd have to go look at my files. But a good 12 or 15 years, I think.
Okay.
I ran that. And I organized it. And Dave Lee's wife, Charlotte, he met her when he worked at White Mountain in the Owens Valley.
Okay.
White Mountains are up at 14,000 feet.
Yes.
And Charlotte was the cook up there. And Dave and her got to be friendly and eventually got married. They got married in the Caribbean, of all things,
huh?
By a British sea captain.
Oh my gosh!
And there was some question about whether that marriage was even legal in America. And older people don't give a shit about that kind of stuff.
Right.
I mean, we're married; we're gonna go with it.
Somebody somewhere does.
Whether it's legal or not, who cares? Anyway, so Charlotte became she cooked for us.
Oh wow!
Because
okay.
It was an overnight thing, and we met and. There's a goofy place as you drive from Southern California to Las Vegas called Zyzyks. That's, God, I don't know how to spell it. Z-Z-Z-Y-X-Y-Z or something. Zyzyks. I'll have to look the spelling up for you. I can't remember. The sign is right on the road.
Okay.
And Zyzyk is was a resort that some goofball guy built down on the edge of Lake Mojave, and then eventually the BLM goes, wait a minute, this guy's built all these buildings down there, you know, two stories and,
wow.
You know, multiple structures around a little pond, and the pond's got, you know, pupfish in it.
Oh my gosh.
And they finally, you know, looked into this, and the guy didn't have any legal title to the property. He just squatted on it and built this entire complex of buildings.
Gosh.
So the BLM took it over, and they go, okay, now we got it. Now what are we going to do with it? So what they did is one of the Cal State colleges here in California, Cal State San Bernardino maybe, one of those guys, took over the administration of it, and they took care of the upkeep and all that kind of stuff on it.
Okay, are they still doing it? They're still using it today?
They are still using it today, and it's used for educational purposes.
Oh, so cool!
All kinds of groups go out there, and you know they got places for the kids to stay, and then they can run field trips, whatever their interest is, whether it's botany or zoology. Or
Mojave Rock Art.
The only people that didn't for archaeology was me and the people I organized.
So we
ran our thing out there.
Got it. So yeah. you ran the Mojave Rock Art Research Program out of that location.
Yeah.
Which I can't pronounce.
For a number of years.
The Zeitzweiss.
Initially, Dave was the site steward for a California, okay, this is kind of hard to explain. California has, throughout the state of California, portions of land that they have set aside for research purposes and to preserve.
Okay.
And those facilities are in a variety of different environmental contexts. So they have a research center at a place called Granite Mountains in the Mojave, which is probably halfway between Beautiful Needles and Barstow.
Okay.
And so Dave Lee, who I finally met and who I just talked to this morning,
oh, good.
Was the site steward there.
Okay.
And Dave had construction skills. In fact, he even built a brand new house for the director of the Granite Mountains out there.
Wow. Okay.
By himself. Took him a while.
Wow.
And And then he took over a partial stone structure that he turned into a house that was ejected adjacent to a gigantic granite boulder.
Oh, wow.
And he put a roof on it, and he and Charlotte lived in that for a number of years. And it was great because in the wintertime, they built a fire in there with firewood that he brought from somewhere, a construction site somewhere else. And that place, that granite boulder radiated the heat from that fire, and that was really toasty in the winter. I used to love to come in there in the winter and get out of the cold.
Wow. Huh.
So I stayed there numerous times.
Nice.
So anyway, Dave was a marvelous guy, a guy with no formal education, self-taught, got this site steward job in the Mojave and taught himself this and that. And then he and I hooked up together. And he got interested in what I was doing, the rock art. And he and Charlotte eventually became big-time rock art recorders.
Oh, wow.
And even more bizarre, they got hooked into Australia.
Oh, wow.
To the Northwest Territories. And he got friendly with an Aborigine guy named Bill Harney.
Okay.
And Bill Harney was an excellent artist. Who used to do his initial paintings. He did paintings. His initial paintings were on eucalyptus bark.
Whoa.
And eventually, that was a little hard to sell, so he eventually got to doing it on canvas. And so he sold his paintings for quite a bit of money.
Good for him.
Anyway, Dave got interested in the rock art out there, and so they would go out with Bill, and they'd go to an archaeological site, and Dave would set up a tripod and put his camera on there and then get out of the way. And Bill Harney would take a long stick and sit in a folding chair they brought for him. And he would point to every element on the panel of a big boulder and tell him what it was.
Wow.
And that just doesn't happen in rock art. I mean, I've never been on a site where I've ever had a Native American tell me, okay, this is this, this is that. And so they did that for, gosh,
but don't
maybe
the,
15 years, maybe.
Don't the Australian Aborigines have a much different approach to their rock art? It is, they can talk it.
Oh, God, do they ever.
Which is really interesting.
It is really interesting. And that's why Dave got hooked and he went back year after year year for a number of years.
Cool.
And he published on it.
Nice.
He produced a book and. Yeah, he did some great stuff with them. In fact, eventually he was with the tribe was called the Wardaman, 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 and they eventually adopted he and Charlotte into the tribe.
Nice.
And so Dave and Charlotte both had Wardaman names.
Whoa, very good.
Which I can't spell or even pronounce.
Right.
But anyway, so he really got into it. Yeah.
Nice.
And he still to this day, he told me to tell you this. He said, I still owe my survival to you, Don, because you got me into rock art research and it took me in a lot of different places that I
cool
never even
that?
Knew existed.
Well,
this
is really cool. I wanted to go back for a minute to the first Mojave Rock Art Research Program conference that you had, you know, you and Jerry, not knowing anybody else out there.
Yeah.
Did Dave show up for that?
Oh, we held it at the Granite Mountains.
Okay. So he would have been right there.
And Charlotte managed to be able to do that.
She could.
On one occasion, my wife went out and helped her. And then after that, Elaine told me, she's I was basically in Charlotte's way.
She is so
proficient in cooking for large groups, and
wow.
It doesn't bother her because she's done it for years.
Right.
So anyway, yeah. So Dave launched a career that's still going, and he lives in Lone Pine in the Owens Valley now.
Oh, wow.
And he's monitoring a piece of property for some people who have hired him to do this.
Okay.
And it's got five different residences on it. And my youngest son and his son just stopped by to deliver Dave a big portfolio of slides that he needs for research in the Owens Valley.
Cool.
That I had taken.
Okay.
And so they got to meet Dave, and it went out really well.
Oh, that's awesome.
And he's even got two dogs and a cat now, which Dave he did. They didn't have a dog once.
He's slowing down a little bit.
Yeah. So he's still doing his thing, and he still lives out in the boonies, which he prefers.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, he was raised by a woman who was, I think, a hippy-dippy, and they lived in Baja, California, on a subsistence diet, barely survived. And,
okay.
you know,
that's lovely.
It's a different period of time.
Yeah.
60s was a different period of time.
It was.
Okay, moving on.
So let's talk about the first Mojave Rock Art Research Program conference. How many people showed up? I mean, you had no clue. How did you get the word out?
I invited a whole bunch of folks, and we got about 20, 25 people showed up, and I was stunned.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I was so glad that Charlotte was prepared for the whatever.
Right.
And she had enough food to feed all those folks. We had folks contribute money. They paid for the lodgings and stuff.
Okay.
And we had to pay, BLM for accommodations, and it was minimal. I mean, they didn't charge us much money.
Right.
So anyway, so we got really into the Mojave and made some good friends that lasted a long period of time.
Do you remember any of the programs from that first conference? Were any of them eyebrow raising for you?
No.
Okay.
The people were.
Okay.
That's when I first met Steve Frears.
Oh, really?
And Steve Frears is one of the brighter people I've ever known.
Yeah.
Who eventually became a high school science teacher, taught chemistry. And when I knew him, he was a physical therapist.
Right.
And a physical therapist is a tough job because it physically beats you up. And so, you know, Steve had worked on Olympic athletes as a physical therapist.
Okay.
And but he goes, you know, I don't think I want to do this all my life. So he went back to school and got a teaching credential and became a chemistry teacher.
Wow. Okay.
So that was a long time relationship. And Steve now lives in Boise, Idaho, because he has grandchildren there. So
right.
You know how that is. Grandchildren are a gigantic magnet. But he's still researching on a piece of a proper, big piece of property in San Diego County. So he still pops in here and occasionally I get to see him.
Right.
Who else? Oh, we got Jeff LaFave. That's Jeff is LaFave. LaFave. Jeff was an attorney in San Diego.
Okay.
Rock art people are from diverse backgrounds.
Yeah.
And I met Jeff LaFave, and he is still one of the people I keep contacts with.
Cool.
Okay. So I established some relationships with people that went for a long time.
Wow.
Jeff has produced a beautiful book called Rock Art of the World.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know how much he sells it for. It's nothing but colored pictures of rock art from around the world that he has taken.
Wow.
And of course, being an attorney, he's got the wherewithal financially to go to, you know,
around
Scandinavia,
the world. Yeah.
Or Australia, or India, all over the world. He even on one occasion, he got a guy that took him in a four-wheel drive vehicle, and they met in Egypt, and they drove out into probably Libya, where they weren't supposed to go, but nobody is out there to check on you.
Right.
Because it's just one big freaking desert.
Right.
And there are depictions of giraffes and rhinoceroses on the rock art in the Sahara.
Wow.
Now go figure that one out.
Climate change. Amazing. Huh.
Boy, big time.
Wow.
So anyway, that was good for me because I'm not the type of guy that's going to go to a conference and walk around and shake people's hands and go, "Hey, I'm Don Christensen. Who are you?"
Right.
But it was in the course of breaks and lunch and that kind of stuff. You do, you know, start talking to people and you start making some connections that way.
Nice.
Jerry has been always reluctant to do that. Jerry gets squeamish, but,
Let's say he's squeamish. He's reserved. He's shy.
He's reserved. Yeah, he's a little reluctant to do that.
Yeah, that's okay.
Anyway,
he got other skills.
But he will be very useful because he will make some friendships. And we'll get to that later.
Okay.
All right. So that I did a lot of work in the Mojave, and that's kind of hard to explain because there's so much diversity out there. Okay. Meantime, I am through at Petrified Forest.
Yes.
But I have made some inroads with people who are working in the Kaibab National Forest. And the Kaibab is, as you well know, is an interesting place because it's like bookends to the Grand Canyon. So there's a South Kaibab and there's a North Kaibab.
Right.
So they have one office in Williams and they have another office in beautiful Kanab.
Or Fredonia. No, that's BLM.
Fredonia's BLM, yeah.
Kanab, right, has four service.
I don't do anything in Fredonia, so I don't have to work with the so-called, what Dave Lee calls the crystal liquors.
Okay.
Anyway, so I make some contacts with those folks, and boy, I kept contact with those guys for a long time. Now that's we got into some whole different new folks that I didn't know anything about. So I met some of the guys. We met them in Snake Gulch.
So do you mean like agency wise? Because you hadn't worked with Forest Service
agency
mentality
before. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The box got a contract to record rock art at a place in Snake Gulch, and so they actually provided a teamster who brought in water for us in canisters.
Okay.
On his horses.
Okay.
So we had water, which is a serious problem in that part of the world. And while we were there, there was four guys from Kaibab National Forest that came in, and they built a trail up the tail slope to some gigantic rock art panels up above on the face of the cliff.
Oh, wow.
So okay. I got to talking to those guys. And they go, well, look, you guys ought to come to the Kaibab and record rock art. And I had stopped and looked at a few sites in the Kaibab. So that eventually led me to a guy, Dr. John Hanson.
Okay.
H-A-N-S-O-N. And he was the head archaeologist for the entire Kaibab forest, both north and south.
Okay.
And Dr. John was a great guy. We ran into a cultural group called the Kohoninya, and I didn't know anything about the Kohoninya. That's Kohoninya, Kohoninya. So somehow John said, well, you ought to come over and I'll tell you everything you need to know about the Kohoninya.
Okay.
So Jerry and I drove over there in the wintertime, and as we're coming into Williams, it's snowing.
Okay.
And I go, boy, you know, we picked a good day to be inside talking to Dr. John, and it was. And so we sat down with Dr. John Hanson, and he talked to us for about 5 hours.
Nice.
And gave us all the poop on the Kohoninya that we needed to get off to a start with.
Wow.
And it was like a seminar. And I'm scribbling notes like a maniac trying to keep up with him. And Dr. John was an engaging character and a very interesting guy, PhD, but a character and a nice guy.
Nice.
And so he was important.
Okay.
Okay. We met through him, his field archaeologist, and one was Neil Weintraub.
Okay.
Weintraub. And the other one was Larry Lesko, Lesko. And so I would work with Neil and Larry on sites that they needed recording. And, you know, I was basically at their disposal. Tell me what you need to record and I'll go out and do it.
Okay, Don, hang on a second because there's
yeah.
I see rabbit holes right and left. I'm going to back up a little bit.
Okay.
So the box got you to Snake Gulch. Now,
when
you say Snake Gulch, I think of a place like you recorded in Hualapai Valley. This is a huge area. There's a lot of rock art there. But you'd already done the Hualapai Valley, so you knew, oh yeah, they dropped me off at one boulder and half mile away I stopped at another, and half mile away we were at a third, and they were all connected.
But that stuff is all out of the Hualapai Valley. You're up in the mountains.
Okay.
You're up on the Colorado Plateau now.
Right. So there's a difference between Snake Gulch and the Hualapai Valley. What I'm saying is similar is the size of the locale. It's kind of both are big areas with just massive amounts of rock art.
And I'm going to be there for a lot of years.
I was going to say, how long did it take you to get through Snake Gulch?
I don't know how long it took. I went on this project with the box, and that got us in there. And then what I did, they had run a pit program. That's Passports in Time.
Okay.
They had run a pit project in Snake Gulch. And they had some people who were pretty good artists, and they went in and drew a lot of the panels.
Okay.
And the problem was they did a lot of them in colored pencils.
Ah.
Now, when you take that to the copy machine and try to copy it, it doesn't work.
Oh, no.
It's got to be in black and white, or it's not going to reproduce to the point where you can see it. So anyway, what I did is I started going in and recording sites that they had not done, they had missed.
Okay.
Because Snake Gulch runs for maybe 15 miles, 12 miles.
Mm.
It's a long, long thing. So I went in and did the ones they missed and ones that the photographs were just not sufficient.
Okay.
So that was.
So you're talking about decades, a couple decades in there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Decades, at least.
And this would be going out there for a week or two every year?
Yeah. Yeah. Usually not 2 weeks. I didn't go for a week.
Okay.
The problem is you get over there and there are sites here and there and everywhere, and it's very easy to get sidetracked.
Okay.
Ooh, that's a neat place. Let's look at that. Ooh, we're here. Let's go ahead and record it.
Mm-hmm.
And at that same period of time, working with the Kaibab folks, I got to meet the gal who was the archaeologist at the Grand Canyon. And her name was Jan Balsam.
Okay.
B-A-L-S-A-M. I think it's S-A-M, or maybe it's S-U-N. I can't. And she was a prickly character.
Okay.
Hang
on a second. Before we get to Jan, because eventually there will be some Grand Canyon work going on here, you mentioned John Hansen, and I don't think you were done with John Hansen stories. And then you mentioned Neil Weintraub and Larry Lesko. And so I kind of want to, and then Jan, so kind of want to hear more about these people one at a time.
Okay. John is going to, he's the chief administrator for the whole forest.
Okay.
So, yeah, he's a busy guy, so I didn't impose upon his time too much.
Okay.
That one snowy day, he gave us the big, thing, and he would, come in and check on us now and then, and I would go into the regional office in Williams, and I'd talk to him for a little while, but, administrator guys are paper shufflers.
Right.
And you can't impose upon their time. The basic guys I worked with were Neil and Larry, especially Neil. Neil became my go-to guy. And Neil was super duper. He lived in Flagstaff, and he commuted to freaking Williams every day, and when he could, when there wasn't snow on the ground.
Right.
Or snow on the highway, and they hadn't taken it off yet. So those were the guys I worked with the most. Jerry Dickey, and you, when you do your interview with Jerry, you'll get more of this. Jerry Dickey's dad was a minister, and he actually was the minister for a while of time at Grand Canyon.
Right.
So Jerry, as a kid, spent some time growing up in the Grand Canyon.
Right.
So Jerry has a real affinity to the canyon, and that'll become apparent when you get to do inventories with him.
Right.
So
that's another rabbit hole. Tell me more about Neil.
Neil is a good runner.
Okay.
Good. He runs. He ran. You know.
Ooh, so are you?
Ten k's, and I was too. I never got a chance to go for a run with Neil, which is probably just as well that you kicked my butt. But anyway,
at altitude.
Yeah. So
yeah.
So Neil is a guy from where he'd gone to Grinnell, Grinnell, Grinnell College, and I think it's in Iowa,
okay.
Somewhere in the Midwest. I think it's in Iowa. And had come out and got a job on the Coconino National Forest, which headquarters is in Flagstaff, as
right.
you know. So anyway, he had, and as soon as he got a job out, just it was a summer job, just a short job with Grinnell or with Coconino, he got hooked.
Okay.
He got hooked. And he goes, oh my God, heck with the Midwest, I got to work here.
Hmm.
And so he actually got on with the Coconino and, you know, and so forth. Eventually, in fact, he bought a home in Flagstaff, and he and his wife lived there.
Yeah, we visited
and
just last
and
year.
Just a quick,
some stuff, so.
Just a quick aside, that has nothing to do with my narrative. Later on, Neil's wife gets a master's in physical anthropology.
Okay.
And got hooked on doing research on australopithecines. Well, there's no australopithecines in the Colorado Plateau. And so they amiably, with agreement,
mm-hmm.
separated, terminated their marriage. So she could go back east and work on in collections and museums in the East Coast.
Wow.
Talk about a sacrifice. Holy cow. I can't even imagine that. Anyway, later on, just to finish this train of thought, I guess, we would work with passports and time programs with the Forest Service conducted their own.
Okay.
And they would host one almost every year. Sometimes it'd be on the North Kaibab, sometimes it'd be on the South Kaibab.
Okay.
When it was on the South Kaibab, Neil's the guy that organized it and so on and so forth.
Okay.
We usually used Hull Cabin, H-U-L-L, which is an old cabin that dates back to the early 1800s, on the South Rim. And we used that as our base because we could store our food in there.
Okay.
So we would do communal cooking. So we'd all throw in some money and then Neil would buy all the groceries and bring them up and stash them in Hull Cabin. And then we would, set up the apparatus to cook and to clean and all that kind of stuff.
Nice.
And then we would camp in the general vicinity of Hull Cabin with our backpacking tents and so forth.
Got it.
Or sleep in our cars or whatever you wanted to do.
Yeah. This is you and your survey crew.
We were at Hull Cabin in 2011 when the towers got nailed in New York.
Okay.
And I'll never forget that because everybody was getting their gear together and so on and so forth. And a couple of the cars were parked off in the forest, 100 yards away. And guys had started the cars up and had driven them down the whole cabin to pick up everybody because we were going to go into different groups to go out and do survey. And the guy had the radio on. He turned the radio on to get the weather report. And all of a sudden, this thing about, hey, these planes have hit the towers. And everybody goes, oh my God. So we all just sat there on the porch and listened to what the radio radio report about what had happened in New York.
Wow.
Well, Neil's father worked in an office about 10 blocks away from the towers. And he had to walk home because obviously, it was impossible for anything to move. And he wasn't a young man, but he walked, the 6 or 8 miles home to his house.
Oh, wow. That's a long walk.
And Neil's former wife was back east somewhere doing research at some museum. And so we had two members of the group a member that had, some ties to the area and was very concerned. So Neil pulled everybody again. He said, look, I know everybody's upset with this. We're all just sitting there listening and dumbfounded. And he says, if you guys want to go home, he says, it's perfectly okay. Just, you know, go and take care of your business and be with your families or whoever. And everybody voted to stay and work.
Wow.
Because nobody wanted to think about it anyway. Mm, I mean, yeah. This work was the work is a distraction, as you well know.
Yeah.
So everybody signed on. That night, another archaeologist we knew who was working out of the Grand Canyon, she bought us newspapers.
Oh.
So if you wanted more information, you could sit down and you could read one of the newspapers she brought us.
Right.
So they kept us abreast of what was going on. So we weren't in a complete vacuum.
And then the sky got amazingly clear.
And the thing I really remember most of all, at night it was dead silent.
Wow.
There were no airplanes flying anywhere.
Right.
And as you well know, there's airplanes going over the Grand Canyon all the time.
Yeah, you
may have backpacked, you know, 20 miles to get somewhere in the canyon, but you're not divorced from what's going on in the real world.
Well, it's the flyway to Vegas from the east.
Yeah, I've flown over the Grand Canyon going east, you know, when I was coaching.
Yeah.
We're going back east to run somewhere with the team. And I loved that. I'd always get a window seat.
Mm.
And wow, the canyon from there is something else. Anyway, so that's a digression that we don't need to.
Okay. Anything else about Neil you want to recall?
No, Neil, great guy.
Okay.
We couldn't ask for a better boss.
Larry Lesko.
Larry Lesko was the second in command, and Larry was the same kind of guy. Really good guy.
Okay.
I can't remember too much about his personal life. I spent most of my time with Neil.
Okay.
Anyway.
All right.
Okay.
I'm wondering, we've been visiting for over an hour here.
Okay.
I mean, and you mentioned, you kind of open up Grand Canyon with Jan Balsam. You mentioned 9/11.
Yeah.
Clearly you're working closely at that time with Grand Canyon National Park and the Kaibab National Forest. But this kind of sounded like it all opened up with the Forest Service first. So,
yes.
So maybe, if we do a comma in this interview series here, next time we can talk more about what you were doing with the forest.
Let me give you Jan Balsam and then that would be a logical place to make a break.
Okay.
There was one site that Jan Balsam had, or a rock art site on the South Rim, which they refer to as the Grapevine site.
Okay.
And it wasn't in Grapevine Canyon because that would be impossible. Grapevine Canyon is straight down. But it was the item on the map that had a name that we could associate with this site.
Okay.
So I went in and asked Jan Balsam if we could record the Grapevine site. And she said, well, you know, I've had a couple of avocational groups come in and try to do site reports on that, and it wasn't to my satisfaction. I said, okay, well, look, I'll tell you what. Let me have a shot at it. And then I've got a guy that works with me, Jerry Dickey, and a few other people. Let me have a shot at it, and if you don't like what we give you as a report, then we will never bother you again.
Okay.
And so we'll just go off and do a recording. It's non-invasive. You know, we don't do anything other than take pictures and draw.
Right.
And we'll give you an archaeological site report, and you see what you think. So we did that, and Balsam goes, you know, that's the best report I've gotten ever on a rock art site. You guys are welcome to come back and work again.
Nice.
Because we're for free.
We're free.
And that was the beginning of our introduction to the Grand Canyon.
How long did it take you to record that Grapevine site?
About 5 days.
Okay.
And the interesting thing is there's all kinds of superimposition, which makes it difficult.
Mm.
That's why it's a hard site, because you got paintings over paintings over paintings.
Yeah.
And there's representational stuff. There's a lot of abstract stuff. There's stuff that's done with fine line painting, and so forth. So anyway, there's a lot of depiction of bighorn sheep on there. So one day we're working, and I think, Steve Frears has joined us then to help us out. And Steve goes, "Hey, look, bighorn sheep." And we go, "Well, hell yeah, there's bighorn sheep all over the panel." He says, "No, up there." And we took a step out of the rock shelter and looked up, and there's a bighorn sheep looking over the rim rock at us.
Oh, my gosh. How cool is that?
It was amazing. Huh. So, you know, Steve grabbed his camera, and I did too, and we ran out of the rock shelter, and we climbed up on the edge to see if we could get a picture of the bighorn sheep before they ran around. And you know what? The bighorn sheep had not laid down, but squatted down. He's been at his knees, and he's just resting.
Huh.
And we come roaring up the slope, and there he is just, like, hanging out. And we go, whoa, we threw on the brakes, and we just took our pictures of that sheep in repose.
Wow. How amazing is that?
Strange. That was amazing. Anyway, so that's a good place to stop.
Okay.
And we can pursue all the stuff in the Grand Canyon next time.
All right. Well, thank you so much for opening that up for me. Hang on a second now. Let's conclude part 6 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Don Christensen. Today is Friday. It's June 13th, 2025. My name is Tom Martin, and Don, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.